Whenever I talk about spiritual matters, I don't get very far into it before I hear myself quoting Rose or recommending something that I first learned from Rose. And he also had this extraordinary ability to encapsulate key spiritual strategies into a few words, a few memorable words that had a tendency to lodge in your mind. And that's what I'd like to do this morning, is go over 10 of those key strategies that I think together express the essence of Rose's teachings in maybe 50 words. And all of these words, as with most everything that Rose had to say in one way or another, had one purpose, and that was to light a path to the Absolute. As it happens, these strategies are also useful in daily life, but that wasn't their intention. Rose had no interest in helping people live a more comfortable life or become better robots. People who came around looking for that sort of thing usually didn't stay very long. Rose's core teachings are directed at people who at least suspect that their basic problem can never be solved from the level of the problem, and that a great leap is in order. His teachings are based on the premise that extreme spiritual effort is necessary to have a good shot at enlightenment. But he also cautioned that there's no recipe for a lightning bolt. In other words, there's no direct cause and effect relationship between our efforts and enlightenment should it occur. Which begs the question, so why should I exert any effort at all? Well, because statistics show that it increases your odds somehow. Now, there's a lot of Neo-Advaita and non-dual teachers these days and teachings that teach that there's no one here to do any seeking and that there's no effort required to become that which you already are. And it's absolutely true. Those words are absolutely true. You are most definitely already and always that which you seek. It's the absolute truth. But a fat lot of good that does you if you don't know it. The hard facts are that almost every occurrence of realization has occurred to someone who actively worked and prayed for it over a number of years, sometimes a lot of years. The mechanism at work is a mystery, but the pattern is observable. So if we're serious about this enlightenment thing, it seems like a good idea to plug into it. As Rose said, enlightenment is always an accident, but there are ways to make yourself more accident-prone. So the recommendations we'll talk about this morning are by no means a recipe for a lightning bolt, but they may help you become more accident-prone. I debated how to organize this, and I decided to fabricate a little suspense by going with the Letterman Top 10 format, even though the numbers I assigned are absolutely meaningless. None of these strategies is inherently more important than any other. None is a prerequisite for any other. In fact, if you investigate any of them deeply enough, you'll find that they include and imply all the others, as well as 20 or 30 other Rose quotes and pieces of advice that we could have included in this talk. There's really only one strategy. I don't want to spend too much time on the prepared remarks because I think the best stuff often comes out of discussion. But I want to say enough to spark some questions, and then we can get into the areas that are of most interest to you. But enough caveats. All right, here we go. Richard Rose's top 10 tips for serious seekers. Number 10, make a decision and carry it out. This is one of those sleeper recommendations that seems too obvious and mundane to have much spiritual value, but it's deceptively powerful. It taps into a fundamental principle that once you make a decision and commit to it, the universe conspires to make it happen. Making and keeping commitments is the mechanism by which you build a vector, any vector, spiritual or otherwise. And until you've built up the habit of following through on commitments to yourself and to others, to making a decision and carrying it out, you'll continue to cave and equivocate whenever times get a little tough. Rose's life is full of stories about his hard-headed insistence on following through on commitments, no matter how big or small, no matter what the risk. He was once thrown from a spooked horse in a blizzard and held on for a half hour while he got dragged all over the farm in the snow because he refused to let go. He could have got off at any time, he said. But when he took that horse out into a dangerous storm, he made a commitment to himself and to the horse that either both of them were coming back or neither was. And so he held on. Now, some would say that this kind of, you know, unequivocal, maybe insane commitment, you know, is foreign to us. We dropped off at the first opportunity, said, well, it's the horse's fault for throwing me. You know, the storm's not really that bad. You know, he'll find his way back. And all of that may even have been true. But to Rose, it was beside the point. He'd given his word. End of story. And he made a point of telling these kinds of personal stories to inspire others to adopt the same principle. He said, if this sort of thing comes hard to you, just start slow. Make a commitment to walk around the block every day for a month and then keep it. Build from there. Why is this ability important? Because in the context that we're talking about things this weekend, if you're serious about having a shot at enlightenment, somewhere along the line you're going to have to commit to it. And if a person who has a habit of following through on commitments makes a commitment to discover the truth at all costs, there's a good chance that something might happen. Number 9, get your house in order. Again, it's a deceptively basic instruction, but it has myriad implications. Mental and physical circumstances have a direct effect on the amount of time and energy available for the search. So it's a big advantage to stay healthy and maintain a clean, well-ordered life. So we need to tend to the clutter in our circumstances and mind. Arrange our life for clear thinking. Invariably, this involves a movement towards simplicity. Complexity is in the opposite direction of truth. On its most basic level, get your house in order means literally clean up the circumstances of your life. If your desk is piled with unpaid bills, you spend your nights in various soap opera relationships, and most of your calories come from beer, you're not going to be able to think straight about spiritual matters or anything else. Getting your house in order also includes so-called character work, identifying those aspects of your personality that aren't serving you well as a seeker, and taking action in those areas. This doesn't mean getting trapped into endless self-help programs trying to become Superman or Ubermensch. But if you have any personality aspects that are hindering your search, they do need to be addressed in some way, and this is part of getting your house in order. It also means simplifying your mental landscape. The ego mind loves complexity and drama, and by nature, it seeks problems and distractions. And if left uncontrolled, it will lead you deeper and deeper into illusion. So it's good to favor intellectual complexity and intellectual simplicity as well. Also, you need to guard against hardening of the head. The natural tendency is for the nut to get tougher with age, so you need to fight against this. Keep all the circuits open, stay flexible, become as a little child, become a house that Grace might like to visit. Number 8, back away from untruth. This is a big one. As seekers, we think we're taking dead aim for the truth, and that as we proceed on the path, we become ever more spiritual and get closer to our goal. But unfortunately, that's not how it works. There's no way we can search for truth because we don't know what it is, and we don't know what direction it lies in. We might not even recognize it if it stared us in the face, which paradoxically is exactly what it's doing every minute of your life. But as far as the search goes, the best we can do is recognize untruths and discard them. This is what Rose called the reverse vector. In other words, the path is subtractive. The process is to uncover ignorance within yourself and outside yourself and reject it. In the yogic tradition, they say neti neti, not this, not this. The Tao Te King says, for students of knowledge, every day something is acquired. For observers of Tao, every day something falls away. Often one of the first external areas a seeker needs to investigate with this mindset is religion, because religions claim to hold the truth, and a lot of us were brought up to accept that claim. Religion is also kind of low-hanging fruit in this area because it's filled with blatant absurdities. When you look at religion objectively and separate the wheat from the chaff, you'll soon find that the core esoteric teachings of all religions are the same. They're simple, universal, inclusive. They prescribe no beliefs, claim no dominion, and ask you to wear no special hats. All the rest, mythology, rituals, dogma, politics, social engineering, which is 99% of it, can be safely rejected because any aspect of religion that separates its believers from the rest of us is quite frankly bullshit. And I think everyone realizes this on some level, but belief is very strong. And belief is, in fact, the penny that blots out the sun. Which brings us to number 7, doubt everything. Rose often greeted people by asking, "What do you know for sure?" the same way that people might ask, "You know, how you doing?" But it wasn't an offhand question. It was intended to throw you back on yourself and invite you to look closer at everything you thought you knew. He was always trying to prod people into questioning their beliefs. Why? Because the single biggest obstacle to having a realization happen is thinking you already know most of what you need to know. We cling to a paradigm of supposed knowledge in which we require truth to fit and then wonder why nothing happens. We think we already know 95% of the truth and just need answers about that last 5%. We think we've got the basics nailed down. Now all we need is the cherry on the top and we'll be enlightened. Not so. As Rose famously said, you don't know anything until you know everything. As good seekers, we dutifully ask, "Who am I?" But all the while we hold sacrosanct certain beliefs, like, "I'm a real person with a separate awareness, living in an infinitely old, infinitely vast universe of solid objects that are separate from me." We're more than willing to accept an ultimate truth that fits that, that validates that belief and enhances our experience of it, but we'll defend to the death against anything that challenges it. The idea of doubt most seekers have is a fraction of what is meant by it. When Rose says doubt everything, he means everything. He's talking about living with a fundamental doubt that anything is what it seems. A doubt that mistrusts the mind, the senses, and everything in them and everything that they perceive. An all-encompassing doubt that in one way or another continually asks, "What is really going on here?" Knowledge is original sin, in the sense of the true meaning of the word sin, which is to err, to miss the mark. Christianity implies that it's knowledge of sex that kicks us out of paradise. But it's any and all knowledge. If any supposed knowing whatsoever is present, you're on the wrong side of the gates of Eden. You've drifted into illusion. Stop thinking you know. Return to a childlike state of wonder, unknowing, and mystery. Have only questions, never answers. If an answer comes, question it. Return to unknowing. Only an empty cup can be filled. In a state of complete unknowing, one glance reveals all. Number 6, keep your head on it. This is one of my favorites. So simple yet so powerful. Just keep thinking about this stuff rather than something else. Beauty of it is you can be done anywhere and anytime, no matter what the body is engaged in. You could say, in a way, this is a meta-strategy, and all the rest of what we're talking about are ways of being most productive and most efficient at keeping your head on it. Keeping spiritual matters in the forefront of your mind connects you with a universal and easily observable principle, which is that it is in the area of your greatest interest and activity that providence lends a hand. Opportunities materialize. Coincidences happen, revelation happens. Einstein had no epiphanies about art. Picasso had no epiphanies about math. Number 5, look under every rock. In other words, don't confine yourself to the words of a certain teacher or a tradition. Cast a wide net. Be open to finding truth anywhere and everywhere. The downside to this strategy, of course, is that there's thousands of rocks out there, especially these days. This is where discrimination comes in. You need to develop a good nose for bullshit and back away when you get a whiff. It's also useful, I think, to keep the back of the book answer, quote unquote, in mind as you turn over all these rocks. And that is, throughout history, in every part of the world, everyone who has ever awakened to the true nature of reality reports the same thing, which is the person you think yourself to be does not exist. There are no people. There is no world. I'm not suggesting you believe this or accept it intellectually, but if you use it as a working hypothesis, you've automatically eliminated all teachings that emphasize the enhancement of a non-existing self, the improvement of a non-existing world, and compassion for its non-existing people. Right there, you've saved yourself a lot of work because you've blown past most everything that's out there, all the organized religions, self-help gurus, and New Age cul-de-sacs. Buddha saw this as step one. First of all, he said, first of all, understand that the world has no substance whatsoever. Then let the mind fight it out with the mind. Number four, retraverse the ray of projection. Rose often talked about the world as a projection of mind. In conjunction with this, he talked about mind as having three aspects: manifested mind, unmanifested mind, and manifesting mind, ing, manifesting mind. It's not an easy concept, but let's look at it for a minute. Unmanifested mind is the boundless emptiness that's forever behind you, no matter where you turn. This is the source of all. Experientially, it is anterior to the window we appear to look out of. You could say it's the back of your head. Unmanifested mind, the source of all. Manifested mind is the view forward into creation, the experience of world, the experience of life. Unmanifested mind is still and changeless. Manifested mind, constant motion. Manifesting mind is the point of view from which creation is projected and witnessed, the point through which no thing becomes everything. Experientially, this is what we call me. Obviously, what we experience as life is the movement outwards, the projection from unmanifested mind to manifested mind. When Rose advises to retraverse the ray of projection, he's saying, do a 180. Retraverse the ray from manifested to unmanifested mind. Look back into what you're looking out of. Those of you familiar with Douglas Harding will recognize that this is the basis of his experiments, to reverse the ray of looking and projection from outwards to inwards. It's also an interesting exercise, I think, to find a way to let the attention rest squarely on manifesting mind, on that pinpoint of projection through which infinite emptiness becomes this full-color sensory extravaganza. That point of projection is the Creator, capital C, Creator, the portal between source and creation. And you are that. Number three, life gives you all the koans you need. This is one that has very practical implications, and in one way or another, it comes up in our group conversations. We have Wednesday group in Raleigh. It comes up in our group conversations quite a bit because it has practical implications for our lives. A koan, of course, is a Japanese word for an unsolvable riddle that's used in some Zen practices. Zen koans are artificial problems introduced into the mind intentionally as a means to stop the head and allow possibly realization to happen. When Rose says life gives you all the koans you need, he means that the normal course of your daily existence will provide endless organic problems and opportunities for self-inquiry. You don't need to introduce artificial ones like what is the sound of one hand clapping or something. You're going to have plenty in your own life. By extension, Rose also means that your unique spiritual path to the absolute is to be found in the living of your daily life. Your life, not the life of a teacher you think you should emulate, or an imagined life you think better fits a serious seeker. In other words, you don't need to go to India or enter a monastery unless it arises very organically for you. Don't use spiritual work as an excuse to hide from the hand you've been dealt. Your fastest road to truth is straight through the circumstances that naturally befall you. Eyes wide, mind open, heart grateful. Don't turn your back on a path that has been tailored specifically for you in favor of an imperfect idealization of what you think a spiritual path should be. Number two, make your whole life a prayer. Prayer is a loaded word that for a lot of people brings up images of forced pieties in church, the judgmental God, and images of children on their knees saying, God bless Annie M. But if we can get all that out of our head, we've got a better chance at understanding true prayer. True prayer is to enter into an ongoing relationship with the highest power you can imagine and hold it accountable for anything and everything in your life. Thank it when you feel grateful. Curse it when you feel wronged, but never doubt for an instant that you are helpless without it. Trust it, become its instrument, but let it know in no uncertain terms what it is that you want. The Bible says to pray without ceasing. In the book, The Way of a Pilgrim, the protagonist takes this to mean constantly repeating the Jesus prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And this may be a good practice, and it may lead somewhere, but it's not what Rose meant. To spend your life praying is not the same as making your life a prayer. To make your life a prayer is to hold in your heart your greatest desire, your highest intention, and be prepared to do anything and everything you are asked as the granting of it unfolds. In practice, you will be asked to do far less than you might imagine, but just enough to give you opportunities to waver. Don't. Hold up your end, and your desire will be fulfilled. Often when Rose voiced this suggestion, he added a phrase at the end of it. Make your whole life a prayer, he said, and it will be granted instantly. Okay, here we go, drum roll. The number one Richard Rose tip for serious seekers is betweenness. It's fitting that number one should be a single word. It's like that scene in The Graduate, that Dustin Hoffman character is trapped in a graduation party his parents threw so they can invite all their friends. And everywhere he turns is somebody fawning over and giving him banal advice, and there's any place he'd rather be than there. And finally, one of his father's business partners corners him and grabs him by the shoulder and stares him in the eye dramatically, and we think finally maybe something meaningful is going to get said. Ben? Yes, sir. I have just one word for you. Yes, sir. Plastics. Just how do you mean that, sir? Enough said. As far as I know, Rose coined the word betweenness. And if I had just one word for you today, that would be it, between them. But just how do I mean it? And how did Rose mean it? It's an elusive concept, not easily explained, but once you stumble onto it and feel it, you know everything there is to know about it. Simply stated, betweenness is a way of holding your head so that a desire becomes manifest in your life experience. It's a method by which you tap into the law of creation and bend it to your will. a method for transcending the accepted paradigm in which we're trapped, a paradigm that does not allow for creation on demand. Rose sometimes called it white magic. If you hold your head between two thoughts, he said, you can perform miracles. Thought, no thought, creation. Betweenness can be used to get anything a person wants in life, from the most mundane to the most exalted. As an experiment, Rose used it to get the cards he wanted dealt to him in poker. But most importantly, he also taught that betweenness could and should be employed as a means to self-realization. Used in this way, he referred to it as ultimate betweenness. I never really understood the concept of ultimate betweenness, and as a seeker, I never consciously employed it. But I've come to the conclusion that after 37 years of beating my head against various walls, what finally did the trick was that I somehow arrived at a state of ultimate betweenness, and that this state proved irresistible to grace. Which is not to say that in any way I caused it to happen, but there's not a disconnect between desire and actuality. In fact, just the opposite. An intense, unconflicted desire for truth may be the single most important aspect of the spiritual path. At the September 2007, I think it was, TAP meeting, I did a 90-minute workshop here on betweenness. And in preparation for that, I found myself breaking it down into four composite elements that could be talked about individually: intention, confidence, gratitude, and indifference. To be able to walk that razor's edge of holding those all in your experience and in your life and in your head at the same time is betweenness. But it's much simpler than that. And it's not the sum of its parts. It's a very simple thing that can be arrived at intuitively. A true master of betweenness can manifest very quickly, and people call it a miracle. Jesus was a master of betweenness. All the siddhis, the powers that are described in the Yoga Sutras, are examples of betweenness. Patanjali called it making samyama. An unconflicted desire given 100% attention in a state of betweenness will manifest immediately. Truly, you can move mountains, or better yet, open the door to the absolute. That's about it for my prepared remarks, so I can open it up for discussion and questions at this point, if there's any out there. You didn't even have to give me the 10-minute thing. Good question. And for everybody, the answer is going to be different. But that's the task. We're right now living the perfect manifestation of the combination of all of our fears and desires. And the only way that all of those can be taken into account at the same time, while the conflicts of our desires and fears and the mix and the interrelationships that they cause, we are now living that life. To change that, you need to simplify the formula. Obviously, if you only had one desire, it becomes a lot more simple. If you have 100 different desires, if you want to be enlightened and you also want to get a lot of women and you want to be rich and you want to be famous and all these other things, the universe will work to make that happen. But that's a tall order. And it's going to take a lot of time to get those things to come together, if ever. But if you can find a way in your own personal life and in your own personal path, by whatever means, to somehow back away from some of those things, say, well, maybe this isn't that important to me, or maybe I'll just, you know, postpone it. Rose used the phrase sometimes of, you know, take a break from nature. It doesn't mean it has to be eliminated from your life forever, but just for a period of time, you know, while I'm going for this thing, you know, I'm going to forget about other things. And that speeds things up. It's just it's a very mechanical process. The method for simplifying desires is not simple, and we all have to kind of figure that out for ourselves. And sometimes it becomes something which is handed to us. Another Rose phrase is that if something's in your way spiritually, you don't have to give it up. It'll be taken away from you. So if you put yourself on a spiritual path, if your vector is essentially to have a realization of a final truth, then things that are cropping up in your life that block that will be taken away from you. I mean, and sometimes it could be painful. You know, maybe your wife is in the way and you have to get a divorce. I mean, I don't know. Those sorts of things will happen. But, you know, the main thing is to hold your head on that one desire as much as you can. You know, the farthest point of the horizon that you can see, and let the chips fall where they may in the meantime.
Basically, you touched on that, but in my life, I've observed that sort of nebulous, conflicting desires will actually resolve into specific situations or individuals that will force you to make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make a choice, or you can still waffle with it, and it'll just keep coming up again, basically. But if you do ever finally come down one way or the other, then I find that we can redouble a spiritual desire, basically, because basically all the energy that was tied up in that conflict then becomes siphoned back into whatever that true higher desire was, or more intense desire. So that's sort of the way that it's, I guess you'd say, it's redoubled. Because if you made a sacrifice on behalf of spiritual path, then you have more investment in it. Now you want it more.
Right.
You better get it.
Right, and there's lots of, that's not saying that's a trick, but there's lots of little tricks we can play on ourselves too, you know, to manipulate our lives in such a way that, you know, we're sort of setting ourselves up for a fall in areas that we know that maybe aren't serving us too well. Next thing you know, you got an amputation on your hands. Right. Now, that seems to be an observable phenomenon. That if you become adept at taking the first hint, you can save yourself a lot of pain. But if you insist on making the same mistake or going down the same road that's not serving your highest and best purpose, the universe will very gently and then more and more confrontationally try to dissuade you from walking that path or taking that avenue.
Is that why intuition is so important?
Sure.
Just follow
your intuition. Yeah. And develop it. I mean, I don't know how you develop it intentionally, really. And maybe somebody else could talk about that. But, you know, to the degree that you have any intentionality over developing a more powerful intuition, it's a good thing to do. One way is to just continually test it. You know, follow your intuition, even if you're a little unsure of it, see what happens. Just kind of get better at following your gut feel about things and following your gut. And you do need to, it just speeds things up. You know, it keeps you from going down roads for too long. You know, as Rose said, you know, you can get lost in a 20-year bubble and all of a sudden you realize that's 20 years gone. And so if you have the intuition to say, well, that's not really a good thing for me to get into right now, let's keep on a straighter road. The straighter you can keep your path towards your highest goal. And this is something, too, you know, a lot of times it comes up, well, you know, I don't really know if, you know, enlightenment is what I want. You know, I don't know that I can really say that, and that's fine. You know, go for what it is that you really want. Don't try to, you know, scam it. If you don't want to really know the truth, then, you know, do something else in life. But if you really do want a final answer, if you really do want the truth, commit to that and let everything else fall into place around it, either fall away or help. You know, either get on the train or get thee behind me. And intuition is very useful in making that kind of, doing that kind of triage on the events in your life.
Bart, there's two things. The statement that I want enlightenment or I want truth. I'm not sure if that's what I want, personally. And all I know what to do is to surrender to thy will be done.
Right.
And I don't know if that's just another story that I'm telling myself. But there is a yearning for
right.
something.
No, it's not just another story. And surrender is a beautiful and extremely useful aspect of, an almost indispensable aspect of this whole search, this whole thing. And if you know that you're not really headed for, or it's not your main objective is to know a final answer, then that's fine. You know, there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with that. And the last thing you want to be is an evangelist for this sort of thing. You know, if you haven't been bitten by the snake, you know, don't try to get in the snake pit or anything. The snake will find you, you'll get bitten by the snake, and it'll become something that you can't get rid of. And in a way, when I talk, I'm talking to people who've been bitten by the snake or mm-hmm. think that the snake might be hiding out waiting for them in the shadows or something. You know, they feel the presence of this sort of thing, that maybe whatever they're doing is marking time until the snake strikes or something, whatever the proper metaphor might be. And there's no sense trying to hurry it up or say that somebody's wrong because they don't want a final answer or anything like that. And there's plenty of other things to do in life. But there comes a point for a lot of people, not a lot, but you know, a certain segment of the population, where nothing else really matters. Nothing else really measures up. Life is, and sometimes it just takes a lot of life experience where, you know, a lot of things have happened. I've got a lot of things I want. I found out a lot of things I thought I wanted aren't really what I really want. And you come to this point where a leap has to happen. If the problem can't be solved on the level of the problem. More of the same isn't going to do it. And so you start reading some of these people and listening to some people that talk about the possibility that everything can go away and all of that can disappear in a flash. And you become obsessively curious about that possibility. And once that happens, if you really want that to happen, then you'd need to make that your primary objective in one way or another. Just hold it in your head. It doesn't have to be any heroic thing. But you just hold that in your head and you're putting the message out there that, okay, you know, I don't really need a Mercedes, you know, I don't really need a trophy wife or whatever, you know, this is what I want. So let's simplify things and, you know, I'm going to go ahead and live my life surrendered to thy will be done. And that gets to making your whole life a prayer. And then you become the servant. You become surrendered to thy will, not my will, O Lord. But at the same time, you're letting it know in no uncertain terms, if you care to know what I want, here it is. You know, here's the direction that I'm moving and would like to move. So let's get together on this if we can. But until that becomes your true prayer, there's no sense in trying to say that it should be. You know, but you can answer whatever is your true prayer, that can be answered in the same way with the same mechanism. If your true prayer is, you know, for Mercedes and trophy wives, you can have them. I mean, the mechanism works for everything. You turn it to spiritual. The interesting thing, though, is if you turn it to spiritual matters, it also works.
I know there's probably not a simple answer to this, but what's the interim step of really getting in touch with what your true prayer is?
Well, I hate to throw out a one-word answer, but self-inquiry, self-honesty, just a habit of it. It doesn't mean, you know, I'm going to sit down for half an hour and arrive at this answer, you know, but the habit of self-honesty and the habit of self-inquiry as you go through life, you just kind of arrive at it. And by backing away from other things, you know, even just... I'm a list maker myself. You know, I journal a lot. You know, I open up a Word file every month, a new Word file, and that's got all the stuff. I'll start a morning very often by just kind of noodling in my journal file and, you know, what's going on, you know, what thoughts are flying through, and I'll make lists like that. And I might make a list of, well, what are my potential prayers? What are all the things that I'm in one way or another asking for in life at this very moment? Whether I'm conscious about it or whether it's so low level in my psyche that, you know, I'm not even aware that I'm constantly asking for that. I'm using these sorts of desires and prayers. They're my baseline, you know, like comfort or, you know, I don't know, happiness or something, you know, things that you don't even think about. What all am I asking for? And if you keep a list continually of that, you probably come up with a pretty long one. And then you look at it and you go, well, you know, a lot of these are in conflict with each other. You know? And so for me, sometimes just seeing things in black and white helps the process. But there's no easy way. You know, the pat answer is self-honesty and self-inquiry. You know, they both go hand in hand. You're constantly asking, and then you have a habit of self-honesty so you don't kid yourself about what the answer might be.
Lord, there seems to be two different aspects, and one is philosophy, and the other is psychology. And as for example, at the beginning, you made kind of like a philosophical statement that we don't exist as a separate individual, as a person we think we are. Okay, that's kind of like a philosophical statement, but it seems like that's a psychological statement. I don't know if this splitting hairs to make a distinction between these two. But really, what is self-knowledge? I want to know who I am. But it seems that the objective is philosophical, but the obstacles are psychological.
The objective is experiential. If something happens in the way of realization, it won't occur as knowledge. It won't occur as a satisfying philosophy to the mind. The mind won't be able to grasp any of it. The mind won't even be there for it. So it's not a question of refining the philosophy. When I said it, you know, it's just you take something like that as a working hypothesis because all the great teachers say the same thing. So you give it a little credence and you say, I'm going to use this as a working hypothesis. But you don't want to believe it or accept it intellectually in any way. It's not a question of trading an inferior philosophy for a better philosophy. It's a question of somehow enticing grace to present you with the obvious self-evidence of truth. And so that obliterates everything else, philosophy, psychology, everything. There's nobody there to have a psychology when that happens. So those are just like vehicles along the way. You know, you noodle with philosophy and you use psychology on yourself and that sort of thing. But all of that will disappear and none of those answers will come. The questions will just go away.
Getting back to what the direction that Luke was going, just sitting thinking to myself, what am I praying for? And I think this is a very common underlying human theme, is seeking love. So if I'm seeking love, is that not a higher purpose? Is that still a lower thing? Because, I mean, to be honest with myself, truth sounds good, but love sounds like the ultimate thing for me. Like,
yeah.
So how is that related to search, and is it distracting me to be seeking love?
No, I don't. You know, I don't. Other people might, but I would never say stop doing what you're doing and do something else. Do what your self-honesty and what your self-inquiry says is what you should be doing right now is exactly what you should be doing right now. That gets into, you know, the life gives you all the koans you need, or, you know, your unique path is to be found in your specific life circumstances. And if love is what if love is the carrot on the stick right now for you, that's what you should be following. And to have me offer an opinion on whether that's a good or a bad motivation doesn't mean anything. We all need to be tricked into this, for, to be honest. And I'm not saying that love is a trick, but it is. But I'm not saying love is a trick. But, you know, we all need to be tricked into this. Nobody is going to come out of an ordinary life and say, you know, what I really want is to find out that I don't exist. It's not a real good motivating factor. So, you know, we get hooked on something else. And that takes us along for a while. And then something else will hook us along the way. And maybe it's a little bit more refined motivation or something. And I mean, like for myself, I think one of my earlier hooks was a kind of a spiritual adventure kind of thing. Well, you know, this life is really fun, but you know, it'd be really fun to add a few realms and planes to it. And you know, and I read Castaneda, and you know, I want to do all those shamanistic things and fly around like a crow and whatnot. And you know, you got to be hooked to something, you know, and it gets you to a certain point, and then. At that point, you find another book or another teacher that says something different, and then somewhere along the way, you stumble on somebody like Rose, and suddenly everything gets a different paradigm. But you should follow exactly what it is that is hooking you right now. And the only thing I would add to that is that the feeling of love that we want is a feeling that only, it's an experience, and it happens to the person, the identity, you know, it's an affirmation of lots of things that we're lovable, and that, you know, that the world is lovable, and there's lots of things that are part of the story that are kind of wrapped in there. There is a triple capital love that transcends all else, you know, that is usually not what we mean by love when we talk about one. Pardon me, that God is love. God, the experience of God is to experience love beyond any imaginable form. So that is what it feels like to be God, is to be in love. And so to want that, even if it's, you know, even if it's temporarily embodying it in an imagined relationship or anything like that, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Well, one of the things I was thinking of as Chris and Amy were talking is we often, you know, say, here we often talk a lot about how I want self-realization, I want to truth, that kind of thing, but within that, there's so much of, like, one of the Rose statements that I always like to push me forward was, how do you serve that desire? You know, there's sort of the bring it to me, but then there's also a way by which you want to serve the highest. And so Rose said, make yourself of service.
Right.
And then take care of himself, or you'll be taken care of, that kind of principle. So there is that giving side of the path that I think maybe it would be worthwhile having a longer discussion about.
Oh, absolutely. But, yeah.
You know, how do you give and serve the highest as it presents itself in your life?
Well, you know, just there's no short answer, obviously, but one short answer is to always keep that in mind. You know, you meet a new person, this is what occurs to you, not what can I get out of the situation personally, but is this person in my life because there's something I can do for them, perhaps? I think it's always when thinking in terms of serving, it's always better to keep it on the microcosm. Trying to serve on the grand scale of saving the world or, you know, feeding the starving populations or something is a losing battle, and it's not, you know, in a way, it's an avoidance of something that's more immediate and intimate. And the best service is to be of service to those who arise organically in your life and the situations that are presented to you. Because those situations are presented to you because you uniquely have something to add to those situations. You're not abstractly taking on a cause that, you know, has some global implications or something. Conceivably, the people that arise in your life need something from you that only you can provide, that's your unique way of serving. And it might have, nobody might ever know. You know, you get no accolades. Nobody will ever know that you ever did anything for this person. That person may never know. You know, it's better if they don't. It's better that it's totally transparent. It's better for you and it's better for them. But if you just keep in mind this mentality of service, and service is even, I don't even know if that's the right word, because it has all words have connotation, and that kind of has this I'm the giver, you're the receiver thing. And it's not that at all. It's just that there's a symbiosis that takes place with everyone that enters your life. And if you at least remove your greed from the formula, you're halfway there. Because I'm not trying to get anything out of the situation. You know, I'm not trying to use this for my own ends. And then maybe step over the line to where I'm actually more interested in this person leaving this event with benefits than I am with me leaving this event with benefits. And that can become a habit. That just becomes the way you... It's your way of being in the world. It doesn't arise situationally. It's just always the way it is. And it'll be tested. It'll constantly be tested. You know, it's like the universe will say, okay, try to serve this person. Mm-hmm. You know, how about, you know, here's a real asshole. Let's see what you do with him. And service is not always kindness. The best service you can do to an asshole may be to confront him on his assholeness. But that's your mentality. Your mentality isn't, I want to lash out at this person because he's an asshole. Your mentality is, I mean, you may not even think it through, but your mentality is that this person needs a comeuppance, and, you know, I don't care that I get anything out of it. I don't need a pound of flesh or anything, but, you know, I'm not going to hold back. You know, it seems like maybe this is the right thing to say, or that confrontation will just come out of your mouth. You won't even realize it happened.
Can I make a comment about the love issue?
Sure.
I personally have found that not trying to seek love is actually, for me, it's the answer. And that is not to hate, not to have a thorn in my heart,
right,
a little black spot there of,
yeah,
somebody who has done me wrong. Because that actually prevents a person, in my opinion, myself, prevents me from actually getting what's naturally out there. This room, we're filled with a bunch of people sitting here. Most of us don't know each other. Most of us don't have personal experience for any room of hate. So the natural thing right now is the only thing left, and that's a spiritual type of love.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that if I continuously work on not hating, not saying, you know, you get some atrocity out there that I should not dislike that and a person should be punished or whatever. I'm talking about straight up, hey, I keep thinking about something that happened 20 years ago and I don't like that person. I relive the experience and the hate comes up and all this. Once that's gone, then
sure,
it's automatically there. That's the way I kind of see it and that's the way I kind of feel it.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful. That's, I mean, that's backing away from untruth, basically. Try to keep Rose in the picture here. But
I don't know anything about it.
I know. It's just that just trying to tied with, you know, some of the things that we started out with, but that's the process. You know, that, you know, you can't, to sort of retranslate into those terms, you can't really go for love, but you can back away from hate. I mean, and you said it very well. And in doing that, you approach love, or love approaches you. Find out those things in your life, like hate, it's a big one. You know, find out those things in your life that are in your way. And certainly hate and you know, greed and this idea of forgiveness, which we've talked about in our group some recently, that gets into that same area. There's just unconditional forgiveness for the world and for yourself. And you're at least back to zero. You're starting with a clean slate, and you're allowing everyone else in the world to start with a clean slate. That's a big relief right there.
Good. Nice.
On the way here today, past the Fairview Church, it has little signs, God loves you. What does that mean?
You love yourself. There is no God outside yourself. Love is present. love is present constantly. There is nothing but love, but we successfully hide from that truth.
Implies action or involvement.
On the level of the dream, it does, yes. On the level of separateness, it implies that. When separation disappears, there is only love. It's separation that keeps us from love. So words like that, phrases like that, they're beautiful and they're they're useful. And to posit a separate entity, an entity separate from ourselves, a higher power, that then in turn, what we're doing, the mechanism is, we're imagining a power higher than ourselves that then reciprocates by loving us. And that's fine. I mean, it's a good paradigm to work within up to a certain point. But it's just, that's what's happening. The one is dividing into two so that the separate person can feel love. But that's not necessary because there is only love. So that's I have no idea why there's anything rather than nothing. But, if I was to hazard a guess, it would be so experience can happen. So that the experience of love can happen. You know, the unicity does not experience. But once separation happens, experience happens. So, and we like it. We like feeling love. We like feeling hate. We like feeling all these emotions rush through us. We love sensation. We love the sensory world and everything about it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We love it. We won't let go of any of it. Our worst problems we'll hang on to. You know, the worst things that we look at on the world and criticize are there because we love to hate them. You know, the reason there's starving children is because we want to feel compassion and empathy. And it's the reason there's crooks is because people want to be cops. I mean, duality will hold absolutely. There will always be a perfect balance. And then a creation that's predicated on that, to prefer one over the other, is a prescription for madness, which is where we are. So, I mean, there is just, to come back around, there is just love, but we can successfully separate ourselves from it, say we don't have it, and now I need to go find it. That's the game. Let's get lost, and then let's find what we think we've lost.